1106.
This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Robin Wright is one of those highly regarded journalists who has been in the Middle East for many years, writing for publications like the LA Times along the way. She's at the Washington Post now, the foreign correspondent, and she's also written very well-received books that are kinds of overviews on what's happening in the Middle East today. She previously did a book looking at the Iranian Revolution. She's looked at militant Islam. And her new book, Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East, takes a look at the governments of the region and what might be in the offing. And it wasn't that long ago. It looked like there might be some progress on reforming some of the governments that are repressive in the region. There have been setbacks along the way, but Robin Wright, author of Dreams and Shadows, will talk with us about where there might be some promise. Thanks for joining us again.
It's always great to be with you.
We appreciate it so much. Well, let's start with sort of an overview of what we're looking at. Obviously, the biggest event by far, the war in Iraq. And can you put into perspective how huge an issue that is and its impact in the region?
Well, it's one of the great tragedies of Iraq is that it's left a legacy of suspicion about democracy in the region. The fact is people are concerned about the instability generated when you come in and change systems radically, particularly without a plan in place. There's also concern about the divide among communities, whether it's Shiite, Sunni, or the ethnic divide, and what that unleashes.
And I assume almost all these countries have their versions of this.
They do indeed. And in some countries like Lebanon, you have 17 recognized religious communities,
wow,
all of which have a portion of power in the political system.
Lebanon's not that big.
It's 1,000 square miles smaller than Connecticut.
So with this kind of wariness, even among the populace that feels it's repressed by its governments, then how has this changed the kind of political dialogue on the street or in the universities of these countries?
Well, the thing that has struck me after covering the region for 35 years is that we have begun to see a rejection of the extremist movements. There is a sense in the region increasingly that they have not provided the tangible solutions. They can destruct, but they can't provide constructive alternatives. And people in the region have the same problems they do everywhere in the world, whether it's healthcare, job opportunity,
education
prospect for the next generation. And the overwhelming majority of people in the region are now under the age of 30, in some countries up to 70%.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are a lot of new agents of change who are emerging, helped by the tools of information technology, giving them means of communicating, circumventing state-controlled press, circumventing the autocrats, and even to some degree challenging the theocrats.
If, though, you look at Iraq and you say, well, maybe democracy isn't the answer for us, what are the other alternatives then, even with these new technologies, these ways of potentially organizing or at least sharing information about groups that might want to take on the government? What's the competing model?
Well, I'm not sure that there is a competing model. I think at the end of the day, the majority of people in the region do want democracy, but it's how do you achieve it? And clearly there's been a rejection of the use of force. Clearly there's a rejection across the board of it being imposed by an outside power. But it's how you do it and over what period of time. The challenge for the United States now is we face, in virtually all of the 22 Muslim countries of the region, autocrats who control power. Many of them are closest allies. And that has led to a discrediting of U.S. foreign policy. And this is, a great challenge for our long-term interests. We want stability in the region. And it's going to be increasingly difficult as long as we align ourselves with the likes of the kings and the sultans and people like Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, who's now run his country since 1981, longer in a 6,000-year history than anyone but two pharaohs.
I read that in your book, and I couldn't believe it. I thought that's – so he's called Pharaoh Mubarak? Well, what is the catch-22 here, though? If we've seen in Iraq, if perhaps one of the lessons is, at least for those who were against the war, that you go in and, you know, you mess with the devil that you know, and you end up with something that might be, you know, even more of a problem. So the U.S. has these cozy relationships with these autocrats. But if the U.S. starts shaking it up or putting pressure on these countries, does it not run the risk of potentially, you know, setting off problems in those countries where, stability is threatened?
There's always the danger. Transitions are always tumultuous. Often short-term can produce results or instability that's against our interest. But in the long term, it is in our interest to see change in the region. And the striking thing about the Middle East today is the majority of people understand what's happened in the rest of the world over the last 30 years, with the end of military dictatorships in Latin America, the demise of apartheid and minority rule in Africa, the collapse of communism in the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc. And there is a sense, because of globalization, that they want to be part of it. And the striking thing, what I try to do in my book, is look for the equivalent of the Lech Walesas and the Nelson Mandelas, who the people who are trying to carve out new political space, who are defying their governments, often at extraordinary personal cost, some of them going to prison as a result, but have redefined the political debate inside the region. The greatest mistake the United States made in going into Iraq was we had no clue what was happening inside the country. We relied on a group of exiles, the leader of whom had not been to Iraq since 1958, since he was a teenager, Ahmed Chalabi. And the reason I went back to the region and spent a year wandering it again was to get a sense of who are the people who really could lead the way to a different kind of future, and what are they doing? And they covered the full range, a woman who grew up in a harem in Morocco in my lifetime, who with every other woman in her family was illiterate, and convinced her father to let her go to school. And she ended up at the Sorbonne and then at Brandeis, where she did her PhD. And she's now the Arab world's leading feminist, redefining issues of for women throughout the region. Another, the Nelson Mandela of Syria, a man who went to prison over and over and over. The third time he was picked up when he was 50. And he was held in a room the size of an elevator with no toilet, no furniture, no window. Had no access to the outside world, was never officially charged, never tried, never knew how long he was going to be held. He kept his sanity by taking small, uncooked kernels of rice from his soup at night, and during the day using them to build geographic designs on the floor of his cell. And he did this for 18 years. And he came out at the age of 68. And what did he do? He continued challenging the regime. And what happened? He went back to jail. And I talked to him a few weeks after he came out the fourth time, now in his mid-70s. And he still is outspoken in challenging a totalitarian regime. So there are people out there, but we spend so much time understanding the Middle East in terms of only the Arab-Israeli conflict and only Iraq that we're not looking at the other forces of change in the region.
But given the fact that he's been imprisoned so many times for his political activism, he's got to be one of a few, because, I mean, the chilling effect of that is so great. How many people are going to be willing to essentially give their life over to spending it in prison for something they believe in?
One thing that strikes me over and over and over in the region is how many people there are, especially in a place like Syria, which is the most brittle and autocratic of the regimes in the region. There are thousands who have been jailed by the family of the Assads, who rule now for decades in Damascus. And there are others who, in Morocco, in Algeria, in Egypt, the leading candidate who ran against Hosni Mubarak for the presidency just 2 years ago was arrested and has been in prison ever since the election. There are people who are willing to do far more than perhaps you and I are.
Undoubtedly. Dreams and Shadows. The Future of the Middle East is Washington Post journalist Robin Wright's book. If you'd like to talk with her about the region, we're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. Why do you think it's so hard for us in the United States to get a handle on the region of the Middle East? As you say, it's often through the prism of Arab-Israeli tensions. Why is it hard to get beyond that?
It was also hard to get beyond oil and the fact that we absorb so much of the energy exports from particularly the Persian Gulf. And so our stability and security economically is often pegged to stability in those countries. And so we're not willing often to stand up to rulers like the King of Saudi Arabia, who, since the fall of the Taliban in Afghanistan, is arguably the most autocratic regime in the world. The president instead holds hands with him and visits him in Saudi Arabia or hosts him in Crawford at his ranch. This is the real challenge we face in over the next decade and arguably the next generation in trying to develop a foreign policy that is realistic, that takes into account our own needs, but also our own values and what it is we're trying to see happen elsewhere in the world. Because we're the hypocrisy with which we're viewed in the United in so much of the Middle East is not in our interest.
Let's talk about what's going on in the Palestinian territories, because now we have a split Palestinian government after Hamas was elected by Gazans to run that area. You have the Palestinian Authority, of course, in the West Bank, and these negotiations that are supposed to get underway with Mahmoud Abbas. Do you hold out much hope for this?
At the end of the day, the United States is the broker in this process, and we are the only party who can get the two sides, and now three sides, together to come to some kind of final settlement. My sense is that the Bush administration made some bold promises at the beginning, but there's been very little follow-through, and there's very little time left now. I've been on many of those trips with both Secretary of State Powell and Secretary of State Rice. And there's such an extraordinary amount to do. And as you point out, it's been complicated by the fact that you have two Palestinian parties, one of which is not yet willing to recognize Israel's right to exist or to renounce terrorism. So we have, in many ways, greater obstacles than we did even 10 years ago.
Well, it seems also that within Israel, from what I read, that public opinion there is much more consistent, much more solid about Israel not making any concessions to the Palestinians. I mean, this in the wake of the Hamas election there in Gaza.
Well, it depends on what you mean by concessions. There are the five big issues that have been on the table for a long time, including things like Jerusalem and refugees. These are all things we're always going to have to involve concessions by both sides. But when it comes to security issues, that's the issue on which attitudes have hardened. And it's clear that the continuing violence by Hamas and Islamic Jihad out of Gaza particularly will make it harder for the Prime Minister of Israel to engage in the kind of concessions necessary to get this process going.
We'll talk about more countries in the Middle East with Washington Post foreign correspondent Robin Wright, author of Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East. It's published by the Penguin Press. We'd love to have your questions and comments for her. We're at 866-893-KPCC. This is Air Talk.
Programming is supported by UCLA Live, presenting an evening with Garrison Keillor. For more than 30 years, Americans have tuned in to Garrison Keillor's A Prairie Home Companion to be entertained by his low-key reflections. Folksy humor and sharp insights will be on display in this intimate evening of stories and wisdom from the world according to Garrison at Royce Hall, March 20th. Information at uclalive.org.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by Dance at the Music Center, presenting American Ballet Theater, performing the world's most beloved ballet, Swan Lake, the romantic tale of love, betrayal, and forgiveness. A stunning production set to Tchaikovsky's glorious score. Five performances only, March 27th through the 30th, at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. Information at musiccenter.org, tickets at ticketmaster.com. Good morning, I'm Hetty Lynn Hurdies. It's been learned that a Watts Middle School assistant principal charged with committing lewd acts on a 13-year-old girl was transferred to the school shortly after being investigated for allegedly having sex with an underage student. The LA Times reports 39-year-old Steve Rooney was investigated on suspicion of statutory rape last year. The case came to light after Rooney and the girl's stepfather got into an argument, and the stepfather claimed Rooney pulled a gun on him. Even though Rooney was arrested, investigators couldn't prove the allegation, and no charges were filed. That's when he was transferred to Markham Middle School. He's now in jail pending arraignment, charged with 3 felony counts. A former lawmaker known as Senator No has died. Ohio Democrat Howard Metzenbaum spent 18 years on Capitol Hill fighting big business on behalf of workers. He died at his home in Florida last night. Metzenbaum was 90. In Mid-City right now, the 10 West is slowing at La Brea and stays slow to National. It's 11:21.
This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, Washington Post correspondent Robin Wright, author of Dreams and Shadows. The future of the Middle East is with us on Air Talk. Before we take a couple of listener calls, in profiling these people, you point out how, you know, when you look for the opposition in countries, you're looking in totally different places than in the past.
That's right. When I lived in the Middle East, I often looked for the clandestine cells, the groups like Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, as the barometer of change in the region, where it was headed. Today, I look instead for what we call the pajama Hadeen, unlike the Mujahideen, the pajama warriors, those who are the bloggers and the computer nerds who are trying to create a different political space through their circumventing the media controlled in all these countries by the state. One of my favorite stories is about a blogger named Abbas who started his blog in 2004 and managed about a year and a half ago to get cell phone video of police beating up a detainee and then sodomizing him with the end of a broomstick. And he put that on his blog. It ended up on YouTube as well. And it created such an uproar that the government was forced to prosecute the two policemen. So there are people out there beginning to hold the government to account. There are now over 1,000 different blogs in Egypt, which for a developing country is significant. And he gets over 30,000 hits every day on his blog.
Wow. Now, the government, I would assume, tries to crack down on this as much as possible. But are they limited in what they can do?
They're limited in what they can do. But there's, for example, so many of the governments are now concerned about the impact of satellite television that they're trying to control which satellite televisions are allowed inside the country through licenses.
Okay. Or do they? I know, like in the old days where radio technology, they try to jam radio signals from outside the country. I don't know if they try and do that with, you know, with internet access, things like that. But they have to be careful they don't cut the whole country off in the process.
But the people of the region are very aware of the forces of change elsewhere. They are tuned in. They understand the internet. They have access to information outside the country. This is a very different society than it was 25 years ago.
Let's take a listener call. If you want to put your headphones on there, Robin. This is Eric in Newport Beach. Welcome to Air Talk.
Hi. I had a question for Ms. Wright with regard to either Iraq analysis or other issues involving U.S. interests in the Middle East. Why is there kind of like a moratorium in domestic analysis and journalism about, you know, what oil and the strategic roles a lot of these nations play, how those factors are weighed in our decisions to either invade, occupy, play one nation off of another, favor certain leaders off versus others. It almost seems like there's a purposeful avoidance of what former Fed Chairman Greenspan admitted in his book is a very, very heavy factor going into how we decide to approach that part of the world.
You make a very good point in it, and there are certainly many in the Middle East who believe the United States ultimately went into Iraq, even though it's not true, because of oil. Clearly, we have oil interests, and it's the kind of X factor in foreign policy. No one wants to talk about it, and Americans, frankly, because of our own oil needs, you understand that in a state like California, mm-hmm. don't particularly want it brought up because that means looking for alternative energy sources, cutting back on our transportation, carpooling, doing the things necessary so we're less dependent on the autocracies in the last block of countries to hold out against the democratic tide.
But certainly it's a huge factor in all of these relationships with countries in the region, and it would seem that it's going to be. I mean, I can't imagine, regardless of what party's in power in the, you know, presidency, that's not going to change unless or until the U.S. significantly decreases the amount of oil it consumes.
And I've always said that one of the major factors in dealing with terrorism is alternative energy sources. that we are tied to many of these countries in helping propping up regimes that we consider friendly to us, giving us access to their oil. And that's going to happen no matter how many arms we sell to them. They won't be able to defend themselves. Their internal security is often at stake because of opposition to autocratic rule. And so we're kind of perpetuating our own problem.
Let's talk with, well, you're not there right now, but let me ask you about what sort of, you know, what the future holds as you look at it. America is not going to be oil independent anytime in the foreseeable future. You've got the issue of what's happening with Iraq and you know, whether the U.S. is going to be there at these numbers or not in the future. There's going to be some presence, one assumes, for a considerable amount of time going into the future. And do you, as someone who's an expert on this area and has traveled in it so widely, ever despair of there being true political reform there?
Oh, I think ultimately there will be. The question is, how long will it take and how violent will it be? The longer it takes, the more tumultuous it's likely to be. At the end of the day, I am hopeful. I do think that we have turned a corner for the first time in the region. But I also think that unlike any other conflict we have ever fought, we could walk away from Vietnam. We could walk away from Korea. I mean, we didn't pay huge price. We could leave troops there. Iraq is different than any war we have ever fought because of our economic interests in the region, because so many of those parties are critical to our own economic health. So even if we pull out of Iraq, the danger of instability there has led a lot of us in Washington to already speculate about Gulf War II, when we have to go back in, as we had ended up having to do in Afghanistan, to clean up a mess that was left in the wake of our departure.
And finally, when you look at the appeal of theocracy in the region, how strong do you think it is as a model distinct from democracy?
The Islamist groups are clearly very strong, in part because governments have outlawed, executed, exiled a lot of the liberals, the nationalists, the Democrats. And so that's left the Islamist parties. But the interesting thing that's happened is that I think the majority of people reject the Iranian model. They don't think it is empowered people. And what's striking is the rejection of al-Qaeda and many of the real extremist groups, because they have not provided the kind of alternatives that people need. And you saw that even in Iraq, where the young tribal leaders have turned on al-Qaeda. In the case of one of them, he lost his father and two brothers to al-Qaeda assassinations. And he mobilized the other tribal elders to take a stand in fighting al-Qaeda, and then mobilized 90,000 of his own people to form a military and a police force capable of trying to institute the rule of law. So there is the beginning of the tide turning against the extremist groups. The danger is we have to see the other forces that are out there and not become so obsessed with the extremists and the Islamists, who are a tiny, tiny minority of the activists in the region, that we don't give real political change a chance.
Thank you so much, Robin Wright. It's been great talking with you. Congratulations on the book, and we appreciate your giving us such insight into the Middle East yet again.
It's great to be with you.
Thank you. Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East. It's published by the Penguin Press. This is Air Talk on KPCC.
89.3 KPCC is now broadcasting in HD digital stereo. With a new HD radio receiver, you can listen to our main service and two alternative channels, BBC Mundo, the Spanish language news service of the BBC, and The Current, adult alternative music from Minnesota Public Radio. For more information on HD radio, please visit kpcc.org.
This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Very pleased to welcome actor, producer, director Tom Hanks to the program. He is one of the executive producers of the John Adams miniseries that debuts this coming Sunday night on HBO. It is a 7-part series that kicks off with the first 2 parts being shown back-to-back Sunday, and it's based on David McCullough's award-winning and critically acclaimed best-selling look at the life of one of the founding fathers who wasn't paid much attention to, you might say, until in many ways David McCullough got a hold of his life. Tom Hanks, great to have you with us on Air Talk.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to finally see the vast expanse of KPCC.
Yes, as you can see, sprawling over acres.
Well, here we are in a lot. What a floor are we on? The 47th floor overlooking all of Pasadena?
Yes, yes. That's a good way to envision it.
You are king of all you survey.
Yes, for today. Let's talk about your interest in projects like this. I mean, here you have your pick of feature films that you can star in, and yet you obviously love developing creative projects. And what drives your interest in producing things with your Playtone production?
It's the long form. Is that movies, by and large, have to be somewhere between 2 hours and 3 hours long, and that means you are limited into the scope of how much of the theme you can really examine, as well as the events that you can actually cram in there. When we first started doing this a long time ago, after Apollo 13, I went to HBO and said, "How about the whole Apollo series?" And they said, "Okay." And we said, "Well, we're going to need 14 hours." And they gave us 12. But what you can do with that amount of time is you can examine the story almost in a macro focus. You get to go slower, but you get to go deeper. You get to go much closer to the human details that take it out of its mythic realm and put it into human behavior that we can all recognize.
So you can see these characters really grow over time. It's kind of like what good television series can do as well in an even longer kind of time frame, because you can really see characters develop in some cases over years.
Well, yeah, and the old school form of television was that the entire story was always wrapped up in an hour. You know, Festus came back on his mule and told Marshall Dillon that he had got the guy or he hadn't gotten the guy, and that was it, and they had a drink at the Long Branch. And that show, the Gunsmoke was on for like 18 years or something
like that.
Yeah,
with the same stories every
week.
Same
story pretty much every year. But, you know, Bruce Dern would show up as the crazy guy every now and again. But because now television in so many ways, even commercial, the commercial networks now they have these open-ended, like Hill Street Blues was one of the first ones that I remember doing.
Yeah.
In which the characters just evolved over time. They came, they left, but with a specific finite amount of time. I think 7 episodes, but I think it's close to 9 hours of television. You get to take people on literally the swoop of a novella. You get to take them from whatever origins where you want to start, and you can end it on the day they die. And it ends up being a complete emotional three act experience.
Well, in fact, in this, as I understand, I've not had a chance to see it, but it starts right after the Boston Massacre, and John Adams, he's defending the British.
Well, this is the thing that knocked my head off, is because we had all heard of the Boston Massacre. We studied it in all those years where you take American history, second grade, fifth grade, 10th grade, junior college. It's famous. They were evil British louts, and they fired on the innocent Bostonians, and Crispus Attucks got killed. And it was one of the cornerstones of the American Revolution. If there was one thing that proved that we had to get away from these horrible, horrible Brits and their queen and their king and all the – and their taxes, it was the fact that they fired on innocent Bostonians and killed them. Well, we all knew that. I did not know that those soldiers were found innocent by way of a trial by the laws in the King's Court in Massachusetts. And I did not know that the lawyer that got them acquitted, found not guilty, was the future second president of the United States, John Adams. When I had read McCullough's book, I got to that place and said, okay, all right, we got to figure out some way in order to make this happen, because no one has – if I haven't seen it, I just assume no one is aware of it at all.
Well, and it's a remarkable starting point to see the evolution of his life, this man who, you know, goes from being a farmer, did not have a privileged upbringing, becomes a lawyer, and then to see how he, in a sense, is radicalized, but in different ways than some of his fellow founding fathers, and to get that distinct sense of where was John Adams's place, you know, within this group of men. What was the role that he filled that perhaps no one else could have in this? And did you feel when you came away from McCullough's book that was really that there's a central role here for John Adams that couldn't have been filled otherwise?
Well, yes. You needed that cantankerous, squeaky wheel. You know, you need by way of mythology, Ben Franklin is, you know, is pithy wise, and Thomas Jefferson is quiet and with a magnificently eloquent pen. John Adams was short and unlikable. He was crass. He made a lot of enemies. He said things that he wasn't supposed to, and he was viewed almost as haughty as being from sort of a moral high ground because he was this pragmatic Yankee farmer. And guess what? You need pragmatic Yankee farmers to stand up every now and again and say, you're an idiot, sir. and the reason why you're wrong is because what you're saying is going to lead to et cetera, et cetera. David McCullough told me this early on about 7 years ago when we first started doing it. He said, okay, look, understand the difference between John Adams. A farmer, hired hands, didn't believe in slavery. Slavery was a sin against mankind. Nothing more than the big choices he had to make was should we grow flax or corn? What's going to hurt us the least? Thomas Jefferson, slaveholder, vast expanse of a plantation in Monticello, had never done a moment of manual labor in his life, short of designing his home and his writing chairs. Service by slaves is his entire existence. When John Adams, that poor working lawyer / farmer, died, he was $100,000 in the black. He was essentially a wealthy man. When Thomas Jefferson died, with all of his slaves and all of his land holdings, he's $100,000 in the red. He owed money. Now, who gets the credit there? And yet these are the two men that it is literal fact that John Adams went to Thomas Jefferson and says, "You have to write the Declaration of Independence because they don't like me. I have made enemies on the floor, and you're a much better writer than I am. What I'm going to do is I'll get up and speak when the time comes." And literally, there was the pen and there was the voice, and the end result was the Declaration of Independence.
Tom Hanks with us on Air Talk. His John Adams miniseries that he's executive produced debuts on HBO this coming Sunday night with the first two episodes, and then from there the subsequent five episodes will be airing on consecutive Sunday nights. If you'd like to talk with Tom Hanks about this miniseries project starring Paul Giamatti and Laura Linney, or if you'd like to talk with him about other aspects of his creative career, we're at 866-893-KPCC. Just before our break, let's listen. Actually, we'll do that when we come back. We're going to listen to an exchange between John and Abigail Adams, because this is a central part of the story that's told both in McCullough's book and in the miniseries, that he had incredible respect for her, that she gave him very, very pointed but supportive feedback on the things that he wrote and said, and that she was a real partner in this.
She was the most important person in John Adams' life, and they knew each other backwards and forwards. They communicated about everything that John Adams took on.
All right, and we'll hear that as we come back with Tom Hanks, 866-893-KPCC. Of course, he starred in so many great American films over the years, but also has directed, and now through Playtone Productions, he's produced a number of prominent miniseries like From the Earth to the Moon, as well as other features and even the television program Big Love. That's what it is. Back with more right after this.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is brought to you by American Youth Symphony, presenting John Williams, conducting the American Youth Symphony Sunday, March 23rd, live at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, featuring violinist Alexander Traeger in music from Fiddler on the Roof and Schindler's List. You can also hear Harry Potter, E.T., Star Wars, and much more. Tickets on sale now at Ticketmaster. More information at 310-451-3400, or you can visit aysymphony.org.
We have a giveaway for you right now on KPCC. It's for a pair of tickets for an evening with Garrison Keillor at UCLA's Royce Hall, Thursday, March 20th. For more than 30 years, Americans have tuned into Garrison Keillor as a prairie home companion. This intimate evening of stories and wisdom will feature his folksy humor and sharp insights. Tickets and information at UCLALive.org. We'll take the third caller at 626-585-7893. Well, if you haven't done your taxes yet, someone may already have done them for you. you. The Franchise Tax Board completes about 250,000 returns on its own. State Controller John Chung says if you're single with no kids at home and only one employer, you may qualify.
There's a fundamental distrust between individuals and government in so many respects. And so we wanted to make sure that people understand that in this case, the Franchise Tax Board wants to provide an easy-to-use, easy-to-access service for them.
The returns are waiting at the tax agency's website, ftb.ca.gov. Chung says taxpayers maintain the option of filing any way they wish. About two-thirds of Californians normally get tax refunds. The average last year was about $850. A few clouds hanging overhead today and tomorrow. Slightly cooler temperatures, only in the 70s. Breezy conditions with 15 to 25 mile-an-hour gusts below the passes and canyons. It's 11:41. I'm Hedy Lynn Hurdies.
This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle with Tom Hanks. And we're talking about John Adams, the HBO miniseries debuting Sunday night. Tom Hanks, executive producer of it. This a project very personal for him after he read the David McCullough book and annotated his volume heavily, decided to move forward with trying to turn it into a television miniseries, and it's been successfully accomplished, starring Paul Giamatti and Laura Linney. And in this exchange from the film, you get a sense of how much Abigail Adams was relied on by John.
John. Vanity.
Vain?
You have overburdened your argument with ostentatious erudition. You do not need to quote great men to show you are one.
My purpose is to show that certain principles are eternal. And that men of great minds have, why are you laughing? Through the ages, agreed on certain basic principles.
A noble purpose, no doubt. But some of the jury might think that you want to prove the brilliance of the speaker rather than the truth of the case he is arguing.
Well, perhaps in certain passages, a more direct line might be an improvement.
Point taken. You were saying this is before he's preparing the summation to the jury from the Boston Massacre defense.
Yes, yeah. And that's an example of how great Paul Giamatti and Laura Linney are. They are the hardest working people in show business to take this thing on. It's a brutal schedule, brutal demands.
This was months of filming.
Oh, it was 108 days, and Paul worked in 106 of them, and most of it is under oppressive makeup and certainly a bad wig, if nothing else. Along with pretty highfalutin dialogue. This was not an easy gig for either of these.
And it was filmed what in Virginia, in Hungary.
And that was pretty. We headquartered in Richmond, Virginia. We shot at Williamsburg,
the historic park there.
Historic Williamsburg, Budapest filled in for everything. France, London, Court of St. James.
As Eastern Europe has become that place that can do it these days.
Well, yeah, the buildings are still there. They have the palaces, and they're not really wired with electricity yet, so it actually works very well if you're trying to recreate the 18th century.
What drives you creatively? I mean, you're at the point where the kinds of salaries that you command for your films leave you seemingly with no economic needs at all. So whatever you do has to be, I assume, greatly satisfying creatively. And what does that mean for you? What are you looking for?
Well, it's the greatest. Look, you're talking to the luckiest actor on the planet Earth. But my first job was in repertory theater, rotating repertory theater at the Great Lakes Shakespeare Festival in Cleveland, Ohio. And I was never happier as an actor. It's getting, $212 a week in minimum. But you were asked to be in six plays at a time, and you had to know the plays completely. And then some of them I was just working backstage, and others I had three lines, and others I was playing a servant to Petruchio in Taming of the Shrew. The variety was infectious, because if you did bad that night, don't worry. Tomorrow night you're going to be doing King John, and you get to become a whole other person. So I find that the great luxury I have is only doing work that I think is fascinating or hilarious or fun. I can sit around and go to the dentist all day long, but I'm too bored. I have to be doing something. So I fill up my plate with stuff that I just really love.
Well, and it's clear. What are the things? Are there particular things that you would say move you? I mean, for pulling out again, Big Love as an example. Now, someone might say, well, here's a show we're going to do about group marriage, polygamous, and the tension set up between a compound and a family that tries to live the suburban big
plural families.
So how does something like that say, well, I'd like to be involved creatively?
Well, the uniqueness of it is that I don't see this anywhere. You know, these people exist. They're up there. They're not necessarily Mormons. As a matter of fact, the Mormon Church makes a very specific, and we do not do this. So they are some other brand of a spiritual quest that these people are on, and they're motivated for very particular reasons. Where does that story exist on television or in the popular zeitgeist? Nowhere. So it's worthy of examination. The question I always end up asking all my crack team of show business professionals, you know, all three of the middle-aged ladies who work for me part-time, I say, is this truly worth the time and effort? Is this theme going to withstand an audience's examination over the course of the existence of it all? And if the answer is no, well then, you know.
So they're your focus group.
And they only tell me the truth. They never lie to me. Only tell me all my faults and foibles.
Tom Hanks with us on Air Talk. He also responsible for the miniseries Band of Brothers, another important turning place
with Mr. Steven Spielberg.
With whom you've collaborated on so many different acclaimed projects. And since you brought him up, what is it about working with him that you find so creatively compelling?
Okay.
You know what? Yeah. The films do well, but in terms of process, what do you?
I liken Steven with working with Thomas Alva Edison. He is a great industrial artist. His mind works at a level of with cinematic knowledge that we mere mortals do not have. He is his body of work that goes from everything from Jaws and Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which is where I saw something that I'd never ever seen before, to up through Schindler's List and even Amistad, which I thought was an incredible motion picture. There's not a professional on the planet that doesn't work with him, just simply because of the fact that he's, you know, that name means something. But his artistry, the way I've seen him on the set be able to take in something that is not working and completely alter it, is it's stellar to behold, because he's thinking in motion pictures terms more than anything else. He's not thinking about production. He's not thinking of lines. He's not thinking of anybody's ego, including his own. He just says, what shot is going to best get at the heart of what this scene is? And sometimes you end up working 3 days on it, and other times you're done with it in 45 minutes.
The fact that you've done multiple films with him, does that change the process each time, because you can shorthand things?
Yeah. We don't have to spend a getting to know you time. And one thing I've found about him very quickly, that he just loves anything actors do. I think a lot of people are intimidated when they come onto the set and start working with somebody of his stature, but he is a fan of anything you come up with. That's why he's given you the job. Come up with stuff. Show me something. Because we can throw this piece of paper away that says what you're supposed to do, and if you've got something better, let's go with it.
Do you have any regrets looking back at the films that you decided to be a part of, or do you feel like every project, whether the finished product was what you ideally wanted or not, something very important came out of it for you?
Oh, I learned something from everything. There's no doubt that there's some stinkers in there. There's some clunkers, but I couldn't go back and say that was a complete waste of time. Every single one of them taught me something that was either what not. Hey, it's important to know what to do, you better have a long list of what not to do as well. And unfortunately, you only get that experience by doing something that you shouldn't have done. And you go back and examine, well, why did I make those decisions? And what is it was that was purely my – they're all your responsibility because I went there. But I wouldn't pass up on anything.
You have been compared by many people to Jimmy Stewart for a variety of reasons, likability being one of them. But the range of roles that – there is no Tom Hanks role, really. You're not an iconic actor in that sense where, you know, every time we see you, it's the same person. You truly are creating a new character. And I wonder if you could speak to that point a bit. First of all, to the Stewart thing, your thought about being mentioned in the same breath with him, and also about this issue of iconic versus becoming a fresh character in every film.
Well, there is no icons left anymore. You know, the grand ones are literally locked in time, and they're Betty Davis and they're Humphrey Bogart, and they are Jimmy Stewart and Cary Grant and like that.
Some would say Nicholson is in that.
Oh
class,
yeah, you know? I would say that. I would say, and there's everyone else is I think like loaded with mystery and talent that you can't really like peg. But the power of the cinema has been not diminished. It's just become something else. When it held that place in the zeitgeist where we dressed up to go to the movies and you made a lot of choice, and also the films played in theaters for 32 weeks sometimes, and you had a chance to go off and see them. They were the true gods up there. Actors now and people who are movies, there is a degree of commodity to it, but there's nothing wrong with that. It's just the nature of what the business is. I'm just the nice guy.
Think that's really what it's about?
Well,
the
every
nice
first
guy?
Every first paragraph of any review, like the film that I did earlier this year, which was Charlie Wilson's War. You know, everybody said, "Well, here's nice guy, so nice guy Hanks trying to play this, you know, boozing, womanizing role." Does it work? Does it not? I made a movie called The Green Mile. That was based, Stephen King's short story, which is really quite brilliant, directed by Frank Darabont, in which I played an executioner. I played a guy who literally, my job was to kill convicts. And I was doing an interview with somebody, and they said, "You know, why do you always play such nice guys?" I said, "I'm an executioner in the, yeah,
but the nicest."
You do it in a really nice way. I said, "Well, I don't know how to answer these questions anymore."
Well, so what kind of a person are you personally in your day to day non on screen life?
I would say I'm constantly curious. I'm fascinated by why people do the things they do. Both big and small. I'm fascinated by the people who come in second. You know, I'm fascinated by silver medalists, because here they've done the greatest in their life. They performed better than they ever have in their lives. They've achieved a great accomplishment, and no one is going to pay attention to them because they came in second. I think that's what the Greek myths are about. I think that's what, you know, Shakespeare wrote about a lot of guys who came in second. The human behavior, the holding the mirror up to nature, is the thing that always gets me in the films I make and the films I go to see.
Tom Hanks with us on Air Talk. I assume, like most actors at the level that you're at, you're very competitive, and I wonder if you could speak to that.
Well, yes and no, because, look, there's a lot of things out there that'd be suicide for me to do. It'd be bad for the movie, but I go to the movies all the time and say, "Oh man, I wish I."
Because not all actors love movies.
Well, let's say, for example, you go see a movie like one of the best movies I've ever seen is United 93, which Paul Greengrass's movie. And I look at that and I say it was one of the most evolving movie, edge of the seat drama from the beginning to end. I can't be in that movie. I mean, that'd be crazy. So that doesn't make me
the nice hijack,
or just, you know, it just doesn't work. You don't get to do that, right? Or a film like The Lives of Others. I can sit there and look at that and says, I cannot. You know, I would love to be able to play a Stasi officer, but there's something radically inauthentic about making that choice. That doesn't mean I'm not competitive. I see guys in movies all the time and say, oh man, I wish I was that guy. What can I steal from this guy's performance here and try to make my own?
Who are the people that you look at and that you are the most impressed with their performances?
When I was young and I was looking at movies, there were certainly all the icons of the day. John Wayne was still making movies, you know, and De Niro and Pacino were just coming. Nicholson was coming into his own, but I was looking at guys like Jason Robards was one of my favorite actors forever. Robert Duvall was this guy who just kept turning up in movie after movie after movie, and I'm thinking, who is this guy? But today, there are people I will pay to walk across the street in a film, and you know, Johnny Depp is a phenomenon. You can take anybody, Daniel Day-Lewis. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what he must be from some other planet
because that performance in there will be blown.
His ability, and you know, and then you get into I'm just a fan. I'm a fan like Tommy Lee Jones, and I must say Josh Brolin in not one but two movies of the last year. He lightning struck twice in the same bottle. I think you're constantly impressed by actors and movies you see, and a little bit depressed because I'm not in that movie.
Must be so funny for you as you know, child growing up in Northern California in the East Bay area, and not having a family anything to do with this. You're married to an actor. Your oldest son is an actor. It must feel like it is so different than the childhood that you experienced until you became a continuing playgoer in your youth. But do you ever just wonder how in the world did all this happen?
Well, yes and no, because my dad was a chef and he was a cook, and I when he would cook at home, the rare times he was home, because restaurant business is a hellacious thing to get involved in, devours people's lives. But he was operating purely on instinct. He just knew what to do. And when I first decided to try to make a living in the theater, I would have been happy to be a stage manager or a lighting designer or anything like that. It was purely instinctive. I couldn't imagine doing any other thing. I knew what I had to learn, and you just follow it along. And if the opportunity comes, you chase it and you do it. And it's the job. The good thing is it's also the life that goes along with it. And to have my wife Rita, she has the same job. My son Colin now he has the same job. And there's reasons to go into it that a lot of people do. Sometimes power and certainly money or influence. When that works out, that's pretty nice.
That's such a tiny percentage.
The thing is just that I can't. This is Vincent Dowling, who was the artistic director of the Great Lakes Shakespeare Festival. He said, darlings, work in the theater is more fun than fun. And I said, that's the truth. It's more fun than fun.
So when you found it, you just knew this was your home.
I would be in the audience of the American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco or the Berkeley Repertory Theater in Berkeley, and I would think, how do those people get to do this for a living, and what do they do after the show? I said, is there a way that you can actually do this, and it's your job, as opposed to delivering soda off a bottle or going to an office every day?
And so now you live this dream. Tom Hanks, thank you so
much
for being with us.
I'm living the dream, Larry. Living the dream. No more, no less than coming to the finally KPCC. I know where it is now.
All right. We're so glad to have you with us. Tom
thank
Hanks,
you.
Coming up Sunday, executive producing the John Adams miniseries on HBO, debuts with two episodes Sunday night, and then the subsequent five parts will unfold on consecutive Sundays. Well, thanks so much for joining us for another edition of Air Talk. Ted Chen of NBC4 will be filling in for me tomorrow as I'll be traveling. I'll be back, though, with you Monday right after the weekend. So thanks so much for joining us. For all of us from Air Talk, have a great afternoon.